Right. I would like you all to stand up, please. Thank you very much. And I'd like you to stay standing if you or any member of your family has had any experience of mental illness. So stay standing if there's been an experience of mental illness in your family or you. Okay, so that's interesting. So that's sort of a roughly two-thirds of the room. Now, my next thing is, please stay standing if you have felt able to be open about your experience of mental illness or all the experience that someone in your family's had. If you felt completely able to be open and honest with colleagues, with friends, with your family about what has happened and your experience of mental illness. Okay, so that's, again, that's interesting. So we've got about roughly half the people who've experienced mental illness have felt able to talk about it. Thank you very much. Please sit down. The reason I do that is that one of the reasons I'm so happy to be here today is I do think there is a lot of stigma around mental illness, and we've just seen it in the room. And one of the reasons that I'm so enthusiastic about poetry is I do think that poetry is one way that we can help have this conversation about mental illness and to do something to reduce the stigma that does surround mental illness. So I want us to have this conversation. So we have an hour, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to share my story with you, and that's going to take around about half an hour. And I'm lucky, I've got my partners in crime, Pele and Bethany, are going to keep an eye on me. So if I go over much more than about 30 minutes, which I've done in the past, they're going to wave at me and say that's enough. Because I would really like us to have the sort of second bit of the talk, which would be to continue this conversation and to share your experience and also your own experience of poetry and whether that's meant something to you. And before I tell you about my story, what I first want to do is just tell you a tiny little bit about what we know about the therapeutic value of poetry, setting aside my own kind of lived experience, you might say. So if we wind way, way back, we get back to Apollo, and Apollo, classicists among you will know, was the god of poetry, and he was the god of medicine. And jumping forward, as it were, to the ancient Egyptians, in ancient Egypt, when someone was suffering from mental illness or depression, which wouldn't have been obviously called that at the time, a doctor would write a diagnosis on a piece of papyrus. It would then be dissolved in water, and it would be swallowed. Shamans, continuing that tradition, healing words, healing mantras. And if we skip forward at high speed through history, we get to Benjamin Franklin, who, when he set up his first hospital, one of the earliest hospitals in the world, he prescribed reading and writing as cures for those who were suffering. Skipping forward again to the 20th century, the practice of writing poetry has long been associated with healing, and there are plenty of poetry associations both here and particularly in America. And what's very exciting to me is that the practice of reading poetry and the benefits that that can give you are now becoming much more known about in both the scientific and the medical world and are becoming much more mainstream. So the first people who did some research on this were in the English department up at the University of Liverpool, and they looked at what happens to people when they read poetry. And basically, they asked people to read Eliot and Shakespeare, and what happens to sort of your brain waves is very similar to what happens, those of you here who practice mindfulness, which is basically things slow down, your adrenaline, your cortisol can come down, and you're essentially in the moment. So a key characteristic of depression is that you worry about the future and you regret the past. So this ability of poetry to keep us in the moment and to be in the now is one of the key ways that it actually does affect our brain chemistry. And more research is being done about how poetry works. I'm very privileged to be involved in some of this myself. I'm working now with the Open University, who are going to do qualitative research in the autumn with the people I work with my mental health charities, who experience poetry in reading groups, and to see, again, how that changes their mood. Even things about the sort of language they use, how they describe what's happening to themselves. So really interesting work there. There's also some work being done at Oxford University. And I think the reason is that we know in our bones, many of us, and I know in my bones, that poetry makes a difference. But it's very exhilarating that, you know, these sorts of clinical trials and, you know, actual proper hard evidence that it does make a difference. So that's just a general introduction, as I say, of why this field to me is so exciting at the moment. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story. And while I do that, Pele, as I say, my partner in crime, we're going to punctuate what happened to me with about five or six poems. So it's a little bit like Desert Island Discs, when you'll get a poem every now and again, and we'll share some of the great voices of the past, and indeed present, actually. So if we can rewind to 1997, and at this point, I'm a reporter at the Times, and my husband is working as a banker, and life is looking pretty good. We've got exciting, exhilarating jobs. We have two small children, and we have a demanding life and a busy schedule. But nonetheless, this idea that I might have depression is absolutely unknown to me at this point. Though having said that, I was an anxious person and certainly a kind of striving person. And one night, I couldn't get to sleep. And many of you here may have had insomnia. Insomnia is a key characteristic of depression, but this was unusual insomnia because with the insomnia came some alarming physical symptoms. And so my heart rate sort of speeded up. I started to feel very nauseous. My head felt as if I had sort of bees buzzing inside it, and my worries were sort of going round and round and round and round. You know, if I can't get to sleep, and I can't get up, and I can't get to work, can't pay the mortgage, children going to care, going round and round and round. It was a bit like a skater going round and round and round, and every time the worries kind of deepened like marks in the ice. And I kept going. And I thought, okay, if I just keep going, I'm going to be okay. So the next morning, having stayed up all night and feeling pretty unwell, I thought, right, refast an activity to its normal timetable. I will breakfast at breakfast time, and I'll lunch at lunchtime, and I'll dine at dinner time, and I will sleep at sleep time. Unfortunately, I didn't. I had a second night of insomnia, and 3 days later, I found myself in hospital. And at this point, I thought possibly I was having a kind of cardiac arrest. I'd gone into this kind of incredible state, what doctors call it heightened anxiety. It's one way that depression can manifest. Other people have depression in different ways. They can have it with kind of lassitude, a low mood, but there is a kind of depression that comes from anxiety morphing into this thing called depression. So I was taken to hospital, and as I say, I thought possibly I was having a heart attack, and I was astonished to be met by a psychiatrist. And he said, well, I think this is the start of a depressive episode. And so it proved. I was ill for 6 months, and this is when poetry began to be a kind of incredibly important part of my story. Because I was taking a lot of drugs. As I say, my depression was anxiety-induced, so I was basically taking a lot of sedatives and drugs to sort of bring me down. I had this very alarming sensation that I was falling, that I had to have something to hold on to. I was in this kind of gripped in this terrifying state. So I was taking sedatives, and I was taking sleeping pills, and soon I was taking antidepressants. So antidepressants divide into two types. There's Prozac, which lift your mood, which is that kind of depression that presents as low mood and lassitude. And then there's depression that comes from the opposite end of the spectrum, which is this kind of anxiety-driven depression. So I was taking these drugs, but unfortunately, they weren't working. And actually, I was suicidal. And the reason I was suicidal, not because I feel myself to be a sort of a, you know, what you might call in other parlance a depressed person. I'm actually consider myself a very positive person. But I was suicidal, and the reason was because of this physical pain. And so I was lying in bed, and I'm very blessed in my mother and my husband. And I had my mother holding one hand in my bed, and I had my husband holding my other hand. Partly because of this very alarming sensation of feeling I was falling. And I was screaming, and I was saying, I want to die, I want to die, I want to die, I want to die, I want to die. I can't take it anymore. I can't take the pain anymore. And it was at this point that my mother very softly started repeating a different line, a different mantra, a more positive mantra, which comes from the Bible. And as you know, the Bible is full of poetry. So the line she kept repeating to me was from Corinthians. And it goes like this. My grace is sufficient for thee. My strength is made perfect in weakness. My grace is sufficient for thee. My strength is made perfect in weakness. And this was really the first moment when I experienced what you might call a sort of stirring of positive will. And I thought, well, you know what? Hitherto, I could see no rhyme or reason to the illness, and I could just begin to feel this moment when I felt that maybe I would emerge stronger. My strength would be made perfect in weakness. So I began to repeat this phrase with my mother, and I'm sure of you will, many will know that experience with a child when you soothe a child down, or even you repeat a line. So there we were repeating this line about my strength would be made perfect in weakness. And so little by little, I did start to get better, and I did start to be able to absorb more. So one of the reasons I am so passionate about poetry is partly its brevity, because if someone's very ill, they can't read a whole book, but they might be able to absorb literally, physically, like nourishment, one line. So little by little, my mother, who is from a generation whose head is richly stocked with poetry, she would introduce a couple of lines, a whole verse, and eventually a whole poem. And I'm going to share with you shortly the first poem that she did that did really sort of make a huge difference to me. But before I do that, I'm going to ask Pele to read my first poem. The reason I want you to hear this poem is because one of the problems with someone suffering from very severe mental illness is it's very hard to explain to other people what they're experiencing. And some of our great poets have put the experience of depression into words. So what happened was we were totally overwhelmed as a family, who was looking after the children, who's my husband not being able to go to work, someone had to look after me. You can imagine any of you who have had someone very ill in your family, it's no different with someone who's very ill with depression. And Sebastian, my husband, needed a shortcut, and he needed to be able to tell people what was happening. And he was given a poem by Anne Sexton, American poet, suffered herself from depression, and he used to use it as a kind of shorthand. This friend of ours said, look, you haven't got time to explain what's going on to Rachel. Give them this Anne Sexton poem, and that will explain what it's like, what she's feeling, and what she's experiencing. So I'm going to ask Pele to read our first poem. Thank you.
The Sickness Unto Death by Anne Sexton. God went out of me, as if the sea dried up like sandpaper, as if the sun became a latrine. God went out of my fingers, they became stone. My body became a side of mutton, and despair roamed the slaughterhouse. Someone bought me oranges in my despair, but I could not eat one, for God was in that orange. I could not touch what did not belong to me. The priest came. He said, God was even in Hitler. I did not believe him. For if God were in Hitler, then God would be in me. I did not hear the bird sounds. They had left. I did not see the speechless clouds. I saw only the little white dish of my faith breaking in the crater. I kept saying, I've got to have something to hold on to. People gave me Bibles, crucifixes, a yellow daisy. But I could not touch them. I, who was a house full of bowel movement, I, who was a defaced altar, I, who wanted to crawl toward God, could not move nor eat bread. So I ate myself, bite by bite, and the tears washed me, wave after cowardly wave, swallowing canker after canker, and Jesus stood over me looking down, and he laughed to find me gone, and put his mouth to mine, and gave me his air. My kindred, my brother, I said, and gave the yellow daisy to the crazy woman in the next bed.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm sorry to hit you with that one because it is very strong stuff. But I think it is an extraordinary description of what depression can feel like and the utter sort of nihilism of it, and obviously someone at that point who had lost all faith. But this is a story of getting better. So that was the darkest moment, and I think that can express the sort of true horror of depressive illness and why it is among the biggest killers in our society. So anyway, we rewind. We're back to 97, and so I've been ill for 6 months, and I do get better. And in this journey, as it were, the next sort of poem that spoke hugely to me was a poem by George Herbert. And many of you will know George Herbert, one of the 17th century metaphysical poets. Well-born, aristocratic, became a priest and ended up running a tiny parish priest in Wiltshire. And the thing that electrified me, which didn't happen at the time, but happened later when I became more and more interested in Herbert, who almost certainly did have depression but wasn't obviously diagnosed in the 17th century, what I was fascinated by was that he wrote his poems as prayers, and he was dying. And he said to his friend, do you think I should publish these poems, or shall I burn them? And he then added, I only want to publish them if you think they could be, and this was his exact phrase, of use to a poor, dejected soul. So he wrote his poems very deliberately with a view to providing solace, providing consolation to people who were suffering in the way that he suffered. And I think if you read his poems, a lot of them have two voices in them. And I felt this so mirrored my experience in hospital, because the poem that we're going to hear in a minute, which is called Love by George Herbert, you will hear has two voices in it. And before I tell you exactly why it meant so much to me, I'd love you to just hear it first and allow yourself perhaps a few seconds to have your own response before I sort of impose what it meant for me. Anyway, we'll hear George Herbert, Love.
Love bade me welcome. Yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack, from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, ungrateful. Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat.
Thank you. That was lovely. Thank you, Pelle. It's beautifully read. I think Pelle brilliantly gave you those two voices in that poem. So we have the voice of acceptance, of love, of compassion, quick-eyed love personified in this extraordinary way. Who's persuading this person to sit and to eat? And obviously it is a religious poem, so on one level you could understand it as someone, you know, taking communion at the end of the poem. It's almost a sort of physical relationship at the beginning between love and this other person. But for me, I didn't really read it like that in hospital. I read it as the two voices in my head. So the one voice was just, to me, the extraordinarily brilliant description of depression. So it starts off in that poem and it says, love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back. And the lines that spoke to me were, guilty of dust and sin. And this was just an extraordinary description of what it felt like to be me. Because actually I had a good life, a privileged life, and yet I had this thing called depression. So I felt very ashamed and guilty. And this is a very big characteristic of mental illness, and I think we saw it at the start by why it's still so hard to talk about. And people still find it hard to acknowledge that it's an illness like anything else. So that line, guilty of dust and sin. I think the other reasons the poem meant so much to me was that I was in such a state of sort of heightened anxiety that I couldn't eat solid food. And what I really, really wanted is I just wanted to get home and I just wanted to sit down and have a meal with my family. So the fact that that poem is about trying to persuade someone to sit and eat just felt extraordinarily powerful to me. And I went on, it's a 20-year story, but I had a second depressive episode, which was worse than the first, a year's illness. And I then had lots of therapy. And when I did therapy, I sort of thought, really, Herbert beat any modern-day therapist, because therapy really is also about this idea of the different selves, the different voices in your head, and how you can hear a kind of self-compassionate, gentle voice and go with that voice and a more kind of forgiving voice as opposed to the harsh, critical, the unkind, the unworthy, which is a really brilliant description to me of someone with depression. So Herbert was a huge part of recovery for me. And I did kind of continue to get better. And one of the ways that I got better and was sort of beginning to be able to connect outwards. So you could say Herbert was a start of that journey, which was the sort of clashing voices, the kind of inward kind of reconstruction in my head. And then I suppose another stage was this sense of ability to sort of stop it, the story being just about me, and begin to reconnect with my family. And a big part of that was kind of reconnecting with nature. So we're going to hear a Yeats poem next, which is really about finding a place in your head, really, to me. I mean, it's both literal, Lake Isle of Innisfree, I'm sure many of you will know it. And I too knew it already, but I read it in a very different way in the context of being unwell. And so let's hear some Yeats. Thank you.
The Lake Isle of Innisfree by W.B. Yeats. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Thank you. And I think, I mean, we know that connecting with nature is very good for people with mental illness. There's lots of sort of gardening schemes and being back in nature, but unfortunately lots of people are either in hospital or in the big city. And I think poetry is another way that we can find that kind of inner peace, and the images that Yeats conjures are a sort of place to go, and they were a place to go in nature for me. So that was another very important poem for me. The next sort of stage, you might say, in this kind of arc from dark to light, and how poetry was my friend every step of the way, was I think about the way that poetry can kind of help you be more sort of attentive and to kind of notice. Pelle and I were chatting actually on the train coming here, and we were talking about how poets often are very good critics because they have this ability to notice. And I think if you suffer from depression or mental illness, you kind of lose that. You lose, I think we had it in the Sexton poem, you lose a sort of sensuality and a kind of enjoyment of sound and colour and light and things around you. And the next poem is by Raymond Carver. And Raymond Carver, many of you perhaps know, is a short story writer, as a novelist, but he's also, to me, a wonderful poet. And to me, this poem was about trying to sort of once again notice and to enjoy. So we'll hear Raymond Carver.
This one's called Happiness, so best not to be dry-throated. Happiness. So early, it's still almost dark out. I'm near the window with coffee and the usual early morning stuff that passes for thought. When I see a boy and his friend walking up the road to deliver the newspaper, they wear caps and sweaters, and one boy has a bag over his shoulder. They are so happy. They aren't saying anything, these boys. I think if they could, they would take each other's arm. It's early in the morning, and they are doing this thing together. They come on slowly. The sky is taking on its light, though the moon still hangs pale over the water. Such beauty that for a minute, death and ambition, even love, doesn't enter into this. Happiness. It comes on unexpectedly. and goes beyond, really, any early morning talk about it.
I think that poem really, really struck me at the time because you could say I was in a rush. And I had always been in a rush, really, ever since I left St. Paul's School in London, which was definitely about being busy and doing a lot of stuff and going to Oxford and then working in a newsroom. You might say that many of my choices had been about being rushing, really, and doing a lot. And there's always another news story you can write. And I think this really sort of began to sort of help me look at the world in a very different way. As I say, the sense of stopping and staring. Robert Frost had a nice line. He said that poetry could be a stay against confusion. And I think it also particularly sort of spoke to me as a woman and a mother. So women present twice as often for depression as men. I mean, maybe that they have more contact with doctors, and maybe that men are just as vulnerable, but they don't find it so easy to talk about, or they're not in touch with their doctors. But I do think there's something, and I notice it with the mental health charities I now work with, that there is something about rushing and that famous sort of work-life balance and overwhelm and being a mother and working and trying to do all the different roles that we set ourselves. So I think the way that that poem suggests that an ability to stop and stare, an ability to enjoy in the moment. So it mirrors many of the ideas of mindfulness, which is something that I've come to use as well in the battle against depression, which is this ability to stop and to be in the moment. And just to enjoy that, and not necessarily to think that you have to find beauty or truth in the special or an extraordinary exhibition, but it can just be in this kind of quotidian, everyday, you know, that poem's just about two boys on a news round. And it's also almost a kind of question of getting in the habit of noticing, and sort of in a way, the more you notice, the more you notice. So we're going to finish with the last poem, and then, as I say, we're beautifully on time, on schedule. We're going to finish with the last poem. So this is a poem, really, which Freud talked about what he called ordinary unhappy life. So this is a poem that I use a lot, and I just use it in to sort of get through, really. And I consider myself recovered, and I consider myself well. But nonetheless, I still turn to poetry all the time. And this poem that we're going to share is by Rumi, which some of you may know, 13th century Persian mystic. And I think that's actually another way that I find poetry so extraordinarily powerful, that it does remind us of our kind of common humanity, not just with contemporary poets, but across the ages. And it is a modern translation, but I think you may be struck, as I was, by how kind of extraordinarily modern this poem feels, and that these sort of challenges we face really are as old as the hills. So we'll hear Rumi, and I think we will finish on the note of Rumi, and at that point I hope to take some questions. So we'll finish off with Rumi. Thank you very much.
The guest house. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows, who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honourably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond.
Thank you very much, and I'd really love to hear from you any poems you love or any thoughts you have. Are there anybody wants to be brave and start? Yes, hi.
I've actually been suffering from depression for 3 years or so.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing myself, I know that.
Good.
But I actually write my own poetry.
Yeah.
A bit later, I really don't even remember being in that space.
Yeah.
Or I think it's ridiculous what I've written. But even so, I use it, and I find it helps.
Brilliant. Listen, thank you for sharing that. I think you make a key point, which is that, you know, reading and writing are sort of intimately connected. I mean, they sort of where one ends and the other starts. I'm not a poet myself. Obviously, I write, but well, what is a poet is another conversation. But I think that you know, writing can be very therapeutic, and is used in certainly is now again becoming another treatment, another way of helping with depression. I think what's happened is that basically it was a very drug-led approach to depression, and because of the side effects and some uncertainties and the fact that drugs don't work for anyone, and also the fact that anything you can do for yourself is a good idea. There's a really interesting moment when lots of different approaches have been looked at, and if it's writing poetry, you know, that's brilliant. And I think the two are connected in the sense that some of the greats that we've shared today, you know, that can inform your work and inspire you. So the workshops that I run, often people are then, they're not set up to be how to write a poem workshops, but often people are then encouraged and emboldened, really, and then bring work that they've done, and that can be incredibly powerful as well. So, no, thanks very much. That's a really great point. Yeah, hi.
You mentioned something about the Open University. Your opening remarks about how this was being looked at in the study, this, you know, way of treating depression.
Yeah, so that's happening in the autumn, and fingers crossed, funding hopefully will all be in place. But it's so I run a 4-part series of workshops. It's a sort of arc from dark to light, so it's an hour-long session, and each session we share 6 or 7 poems. It's normally an existing group that's meeting, so people who are already suffering from anxiety or depression, and we meet up each week. And so the research will be to see in that 4-week period, you know, what changes, if any, there are, to what extent people, as I say, talk about things in a different way in the first workshop compared to the last workshop. So that's sort of how qualitative research works. The other thing that's happening on research, which again I'm very, very lucky to be involved with, is I'm actually working with the NHS, because I made a Black Rainbow Poetry app that came out at the same time as my book, which is free. On Google and on Apple, and the digital world is easier really for researchers to work with, and I'm now working, the NHS has been kind enough to recommend it as one of its main mental health apps, and they also want to do some sort of clinical research, and this would be with the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London, which again is looking at what they call their service users, so people who are suffering, how do they use the app, what speaks to them on the app, which poems do they download, which you can, it's quite, I mean, it's not my field, but I know from talking to people that it's apps are good things. They're easier to sort of track what people use or don't use. So I think it's just part of a general zeitgeist that where the arts and mental health meet is just a sort of burgeoning area of research, and some stuff, work's been done. You know, for me, it's poetry. Other people, it's the visual arts, and for some people, it's music. You know, people find different things that speak to them. But I think that the challenge is to to put some numbers around it and therefore to make it more available, to make it more accessible. Because I think for a lot of people, they think, well, poetry, I did it at school and I'm not interested. So that's part of my mission, which I'm, to try and sort of prove, as it were. The book's at the back of the room, and on my Black Rainbow website are all the links. So if you click on the link, it would take you to the Apple App Store, and then you would click on the Black Rainbow app and download it. And there are around 50 poems in there, which made a big difference to me. And that you do the same. You'd click on the link to the Google App Store, and you could download it. It's free, so you don't have to pay anything. Yeah? So that's something that I'm working on, but we're not there yet. It's coming along, which is really exciting. Yeah, anybody else? Any other questions? Yeah, hi, thanks.
Oh.
Yeah. Gosh, that's such a good question. It's like sort of history written from the point of view of the victor, as it were, before the battle, after the battle, as it were. I don't think I'd get better. In fact, I was quite at peace with dying in some ways, because actually I welcomed it, because I was in such pain and I just wanted to get out of the pain. The pain was so awful. I mean, it was sort of... I once had a tooth out without anaesthetic. It was kind of worse than that. It was sort of worse than childbirth. I can't think of other pain I've had. But actually, when I really started looking into depression, I was electrified again. I came across the work of someone called Dr. John Horder, who was the head of the Royal College of GPs, actually. And he's retired now. But he'd had depression, and he'd had a coronary heart attack, and he'd had cancer. And he said that he felt that the pain of depression was worse than either the heart attack or the cancer. So I just wanted to die, and I sort of was quite at peace with that, because I thought, well, I've got two children and I've done my bit, it's okay now. I can take a break. So I don't think I did think I'd get better. But I suppose that does inform my work, in the sense that a lot of people with depression don't think they're going to get better. And given half a chance, they do take law into their own hands. So I think a sense of hope that people will recover is incredibly important. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, hi, at the back. Yeah. It was total. It was sort of every bit of me hurt. I remember vividly a conversation, actually, with my mother, and she kept saying, but what hurts? Which bit of you hurts? And I said, everything hurts. And your brain can go incredibly wrong and just put you into a very, very frightening physical state. How and why exactly it happens, we're still quite in the dark about, actually. Lots of areas of uncertainty around depression. If you look at the Royal College of Psychiatrists website, it gives you 7 different reasons for depression, i.e. they don't really know, including one which they called endogenous, i.e. sort of seemingly coming out of nowhere. And lots of uncertainty around, antidepressants, do they work, how do they work? We used to have quite glib explanations around serotonin levels and chemical levels in the brain, and they up the serotonin or they lowered the serotonin, and all that's sort of gone out of the window. So there's a brain is just so complicated how it operates, but it can have some really devastating effects. Yeah. Was there one at the front? Yeah, hello, hi. Yeah.
And I just wanted
you
to say something about carers and where carers are.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's a huge, huge topic. And the awful truth is a lot of people are thrown back on their family and indeed friends, and not everybody's lucky enough to have family that I had, and my mother came to live with us, and that's unusual, and I know that's unusual from the work that I now do. So, and how do those people who are supporting you, how do they survive? I think the first thing to say is that I think this business of shame and guilt, which was in some of those poems, it doesn't just affect the person with depression, it affects the people around them, because they also think, well, perhaps I'm somehow responsible for this, because it seems to sort of come out of nowhere, and mental illness isn't simple in the way that possibly physical illness is. So I think the first thing to do is to acknowledge it's an illness. It's not different to another illness. It's a practical thing. You know, someone needs to do the shopping. Someone needs to, you know, change the sheets, get the children to school. Just like if someone had broken a leg, they would need that kind of practical support. So one thing is to be very straightforward. So people often say, well, how can I help? You know, drop off the fish pie, just like you would if someone had cancer. All those things are not being done by the person who's got depression or the person who's, you know, maybe if it's very extreme and they're not in hospital, they may actually have to be with them all the time. So I was let out of hospital on the basis that my mother was there all the time because I was a suicide risk. So actually, okay, who's running the house? Because she's actually sitting at my bed. You know, she's even nervous to go to the bathroom because, you know, I might just grab the pills, except they got moved, whatever. I think that's the first thing. Take away stigma and guilt and shame as much as you possibly can. Acknowledge it's an illness. We're having a conversation now. That conversation has to massively increase. It has to increase in the workplace so that people don't feel frightened to come off work if they've got mental illness. That's a huge area of kind of acceptance and reducing stigma. And I think getting as much help as you possibly can in this very sort of practical, straightforward way, as I say. So in terms of looking after someone with depression, one thing that people have told me that they find helpful, and I've found it helpful, is you don't say, how are you? It's a big existential question, and we're very bad as English, and we say we're fine. So don't say, how are you? If you want to try and find out what's, just say, how are you feeling right now? Or how are you feeling this morning? Or how are you feeling this lunchtime? So sort of break it down into small, sort of manageable, bite-sized pieces. So that's just a few things that, does that help at all? A bit?
Yes, I love to talk to your mum.
Well, I am very lucky in my mother. She is an absolute angel. And she did have this extraordinary resource, which was poetry, which she had learnt by heart, which is another one of my big things, is that only we all learn poetry by heart, because when you need it, if you've got it already laid down in store, as it were, that's a great thing. Yes, someone at the back. Hi.
Yes, can I just make a point about the individuality of depression?
Yes, good, yeah.
I think we're guilty of starting to think listening to poetry will actually help me, but it isn't actually always, it's the different types of poetry.
Yeah.
Which you hear sometimes heals you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people who are listening to it, it's the type of poetry as well. I think that's a very important thing to bring into this conversation.
Yeah, I know.
Because
yeah.
It's easy to think, well, this person's had depression, therefore I must practice some poetry and I'll get over it. But I think it's such an individual thing. You make the point about, you know, the Royal Society of Psychiatrists saying seven different causes of it.
Yeah.
I think there's more than that, actually.
Right. Yeah.
And I just think that's so, so important to express to people that it is very much an individualistic thing.
Yeah,
it's very difficult to classify. It's not like any other medicine or it's not like a physical medicine.
I quite agree. I think you make an excellent point. I mean, I think that's one way in which poetry can be extraordinary in the sense that people respond differently. Everybody responds differently to a poem. And indeed, in fact, they respond differently over time. So the same poem can mean something very different at a different point or a different experience that you're in. So I think that's absolutely right. And what I always encourage is, you know, by sharing my experience, I invite you to share what helped you. So the wonderful thing about the electronic world, it has many disadvantages on mental health, the sort of 24/7 non-stop kind of busyness, but has this extraordinary thing that you can share. So I ran a campaign with Sane, and we shared on the website poems that helped other people. And of course, they weren't necessarily my selection. And of course, they were help. You know, they help people in different ways. And as you rightly say, you know, I think writing it can be incredibly important as well. I mean, there's lots of more precise things you can do, like, for example, writing a gratitude exercise every day, which is at the end of the day, you write three things you're grateful for. That might come in the shape of a poem, or it might just be something that you write down. So the fact of writing something on paper definitely is different and I think makes a difference, as you rightly say. Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, hi.
Hi, but thank you very much. Very, very useful talk. And
thank you.
The point of really point very, very effective. You're absolutely right. There's a big stigma there, still associated with the mental illness.
Yeah.
And obviously, you're doing a great job in this work done. And the thing is that there's so many excellent poems in the past written.
Yeah.
A very short poem called Who Knows. This is about, goes like this, that who knows why this bird sings?
Oh.
Simple yet clever marvel of nature, fluttering around and tweeting its melodic tune. Is it sheer happiness on the break of dawn, or pure exhalation of just being alive, or wondering what the break of day beholds, or is it just call of love? So when I recite this poem, one of the other poets was almost welled up. So I asked her what happened. She said that I was deaf all my life.
Wow.
And when I had my hearing aid, the first thing I heard was a bird song.
Wow.
It brought everything back. So that's the thing. You never know how a poem can touch anybody.
I think that deserves a round of applause. That's really moving. Thank you for sharing it. Funnily enough, birds actually... they're often symbols of hope, and they're used a lot. There's a lovely Emily Dickinson poem, Hope is the Thing with Feathers. There's the darkling thrush, I think it's Lawrence. I mean, I think there's something very magical about the simple fact is birds can fly. It's the one thing that no other animal can do, and poets are often drawn to that. So I think there is something very magical about that, and it's lovely to share that. And in fact, I think being back in nature and sort of how that can help, I think I remember sort of seeing a robin and finding that incredibly a wonderful symbol. Yes, anybody else? Yeah, anybody else who hasn't said something, but I'd love to come back to you. But yes, hi, sorry, hi.
It's not so much a question.
Yeah, thank you.
But, what I found really resonated with me was the connection between mind and body.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
The idea that I think mental health really separates the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, it's quite a process, and I find myself, I'm fully recovered, but it took me a long time to sort of
yeah.
accept the sort of fragility of my body, if that makes sense.
Totally, totally.
That the whole link with poetry and being in the moment and the mindfulness, it's, I think it would work equally well in a long-term sort of healing process after the event, after you've
yeah. I think, you know, you learn to manage it. I mean, if you had diabetes, you'd learn to manage diabetes. You'd watch eating too many donuts. I mean, I think you learn to manage it and find whatever tools you can. Very interesting, that point about mind and body. So the truth is that if you're mentally relaxed, and we could try it, but we probably haven't got time, but if we did a mental relaxation exercise, what you should find is that you are physically relaxed. Because it's actually impossible. Mind and body are so connected that it is impossible to be physically tense if you're mentally relaxed. And vice versa, if you're physically relaxed, you become mentally relaxed. And so as you say, you know, really good poetry, and I hope perhaps some of you experienced it here today, does almost have a physical effect. I can't remember who it was who talked about, you know, perhaps it was Andrew Motion, about, you know, the hairs on the back of the neck. And I always sort of have a kind of rule of thumb because I didn't study English and my enjoyment of poetry is so sort of emotional in a way. I'm a complete autodidact. I never studied it. But I sort of know straight away because I get goosebumps. She's a brilliant poet. So you read her poetry and you get goosebumps and you sort of know. And I think that's so interesting what you say, that kind of mind and body working together and the way that good poetry can sort of affect your mind and then affect your body. Anybody else? Yes, hi.
Do you worry that it might happen again?
Yeah, I am. I don't think you can have depression and not always slightly worry. I sort of think that, I think in that last poem, that Rumi poem, there was something there around acceptance and, you know, what we resist persists. So I suppose I've kind of got to a place and I think that I would accept, well, I hope I would accept what happened and who knows what happens for anyone. But unfortunately, just from a medical point of view, so the pattern is absolutely that it happens again. More than that, depressive episodes are sequentially worse. So that was my pattern. So I had a six-month episode and then a year episode. So it was really why it has become my kind of life's work, because I really have thought, wow, let's not do this doubling thing. It could be 2 years next time. So I'm really going all out to try and manage this depression. So that's been the last 10 years of my life. Anybody else? And we've probably got time for one more. Yes, hi. Yes.
The poetry experience had to come much later than that very early devastating experience when you were helpless.
Yes.
When you needed the much, I would say, malign intervention of the physician.
Yeah. Yes.
And who was going to be put on the road to recovery.
Yeah.
I see it myself.
Yeah.
Intervention later on in that very devastating experience.
Yeah.
Every mental illness, but the one you describe, I think, would not be open to our own intervention.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, and I think this has got to be dealt with care and sensitivity, because people's lives are at stake. And so I'm careful when I run my workshops, and I obviously always talk to the people who, from the charities ahead, because you're quite right, someone who is properly what you might call in the midst of severe depressive episode or suicidal, this is, I wouldn't want that responsibility myself, and goodness, how we must thank psychiatrists for the extraordinary responsibility that they do take on, and pay for it in their own suffering when patients die. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's any therapists here. We got any therapists? No? Yeah, a therapist. I think all the people who are trying to find ways of sort of managing mental illness, the therapists, poetry therapists, people involved in all the other sort of schemes, mindfulness experts, I mean, none of them would wish to say that in any way they replaced, psychiatrists at that very, very acute stage. And it could just be that someone's in such a state that they actually just, which actually sort of happened to me, they just actually need to be sedated for a bit. And, you know, I may have sedated you all this afternoon, but on the whole, you need some nice pharmaceutical drugs to do that. Good. Okay, well, we're bang on 5:15, so thank you very much. Thank you for coming.